Welcome back from our break, everybody. If you'd like to get settled down in your seats, and we'll start in just a moment. Before we get started, I'd like to take some time to thank all of our sponsors. We have Capital Farm Credit, Cattlemen's Education Series, Corteva, the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, Lone Star Ag Credit, Pasta Feeds, Rabo Ag Refinance, Stay Tough Finance, Fence Manufacturing, and the Texas Beef Quality Assurance Program. We do ask that you guys stop by their expo booth and say thank you. And we'll get started with our second presentation with Is Your Ranch an Investment or Production Asset? Our presenter is Tyler Jacobs and with Hall & Hall Partners. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a little confusing because there's only one of me up here, and there's two names on the presentation. Taylor Yates is here with me, and we decided that given the size of this stage, we'd probably be bouncing into each other if we were both up here. So rather than that be a distraction, we decided we would just sacrifice one lamb. So anyway, kind of a tough presentation to follow given Donnell's presentation. I really enjoyed that. It actually ties into our presentation really well. We'll get started, and then I'll stop and tell you a little bit about me, about Taylor, and the point of view we're coming from. And I just want to start by asking you guys a question. So how many Texans do we have in the room? All right. How many non-Texans do we have in the room? One, two, three. All right, there's hope for you. I've been studying genealogy lately, and there's about 10 years ago, I stumbled across a website that said that my ancestor fought at the Battle of San Jacinto. So I've been digging around and haven't been able to prove that yet. And I got all excited last week because the curator at the San Jacinto Monument actually called me back and was about to give me some great insight on where my ancestor was. Was he at the battle? Was he not? And then that tank battery caught on fire, and they had to evacuate everybody, and so left me in a lurch. But I do know that I'm a Texan, and I do know that my family settled here in 1835 in DeWitt County. We've bounced around different parts of the county, different places. I've got for you is are you in the real estate business? How many of you feel like you're in the real estate business?
Knows taxes, because I have a little cold
right now. I hope to change your mind by the end of this presentation, and I hope that you'll understand what we're talking about.
I mentioned that my wife always wanted to be full of grace. She had an aunt called Grace.
That's not me, and I doubt it's the Holy Spirit.
Four boys, and they all started to see Derek, Grant, Gannon, and Gage, and she always wanted to be full of grace. Well, we actually got our first grandchild,
so,
which is a granddaughter.
We were talking about how to put the slideshow together and what we were trying to say. And so you look at ranches your entire life. And hey, Monty, you want to step out and see if you can get them to
cpatoday.com.
Cut this off. I don't know where it's coming from.
She wants to come up beforehand and mention.
And
very easy to subscribe. It talks about things.
You know, one of the funny things about being in the real estate business is every ranch you visit is the best ranch in Texas, right, Taylor? And I have been told that emphatically and countless times that this is the best ranch in Texas. And Taylor was disappointed because I had a really cool shot of a camel, and somehow that's on a ranch, and I felt like this picture kind of encompassed everything we're talking about. We're talking about production agriculture, we're talking about the cattle business, we're talking about forage management, and we're talking about beauty as an asset. And so, one of the things we have observed in a career of being in the real estate business is the reality that in some shape, form, or fashion, you are in the real estate business as a rancher.
My father,
you are in the real
estate
business.
Born in 1912 in South Dakota, was more of a farmer than a rancher.
That's really bothering me. Sorry, guys.
I grew up in southeastern Washington State.
I think it's
but
coming
we had
from
about
room.
35 head of registered black Angus until I was about 9 years old.
Anyway, so I apologize. I don't know what to do about that.
I would start off with that. That little thing there is me about 50-some years ago. That's my father
Daniel,
operating
can you,
that
you think
combine.
You can...
For the younger people in here.
Okay.
People,
no worries. Anyway, so...
The apparatus on that combine. I'm not sure how I didn't fall.
I grew up on my family ranch.
It's a little hard to tell.
And
there's about a
my grandfather's who got me interested in the cattle
just
business.
To give you an idea, that's about 120, 150.
My dad was grew up on the ranch, and it was kind of the scenario that Donnell was talking about in the previous
out in
message,
our area, we call those
where my dad had no desire to come back to the ranch because of the way it was handled and managed in his generation.
Like
well, as a kid growing up on the ranch, I got to do all the fun stuff and didn't have to deal with any of the burden.
Little grade school
and so
first and second grade and one
the idea of the family ranch passing down through generations in our family was never realized,
Dixie,
but it was always a dream.
Like this, I'm sure
and when the day came that the developers started knocking on the door,
are they still brother and sister?
We realized, being a real estate family, that you know what, this is something we're going to have to do. We're going to have to make a decision.
I'm going to turn this over to Brandt
and move on down the road.
Take the first few slides.
The challenge is that we all want to believe that our ranches are going to be held and operated in perpetuity.
I've given a talk like this,
and that is not simply, it's just not true.
Last year,
and what is the reality of that? What's the reality of that conclusion? The reality of that conclusion is you are in the real estate business. Some shape, form, or fashion, you're managing real estate. You're managing, for most of us, millions and millions of dollars of an asset. And most people don't ever think about the disposition of that asset until it's too late. And so today we're going to talk about, is your ranch an investment? And if so, how are you going to treat it as an investment? I don't think anyone wants to wake up this morning and go, hey, you know, I've decided that I don't like this ranch anymore. I think I'm just going to sell it. That's not the way that conversation happens. What happens is circumstances and family and business and relationships collide, and then the ranch has to be sold or needs to be sold. And so for that very reason, you are in the real estate business. We're going to talk about... kind of the two extremes. We're going to define two extremes, and I think the persuasive nature of this presentation is to convince you of one over the other. So we're talking about managing an investment, holding an asset for a future return. So this is only applies if you believe that your ranch will change hands one day. Am I managing this ranch? Am I managing and holding this asset for a future return?
Where the rates are
or
higher,
am I managing
and also for our middle class
managing this ranch as a production asset and just trying to milk every dime I can out of it every year? And those are two extremes, and I think we'll find ourselves landing on one versus the other.
So that's about a third.
I picked two pictures to demonstrate this, and
you know, I've reviewed probably
the majority of ranches that you see hit the market are not the
where tax liability
the true legacy historical ranches that we all want to believe that we own. The reality is that we all have an asset that is not unlike that of our neighbor's asset. And so when you inherit a piece of real estate or you purchase a piece of real estate, there's part of a romance and a dream there. And so we've got the little house and we've got the lake. And you compare that to squeezing every ounce of production that you can out of the stewardship of the land. And what we find is, and what we have found is that the romance of one versus the reality of the other is not a good balance. And you need to find balance in how you're doing this. A little bit more of my story. My dad brought me into the real estate business kind of kicking and screaming 20-something years ago. But together we've always been a part of the family ranch in Southeast Texas. In the mid-90s, my grandfather passed away, and my grandmother decided to give me a set of cows. And that was a generation-skipping event because at the time, my father did not own any cows.
I was talking about the genealogy earlier.
It's really cool. I don't know how many of y'all do Ancestry.com, but one of the neatest things to look at is the ag censuses that have been taken in the state of Texas since, I think, 1840. And you can go back and you can trace cattle, sheep, pigs, farms, whatever you want, and all you got to know is the county in which they operated in. My family's had cattle continuously since the 1840s, but none of that ever came down through our generations the way Donnell was talking about earlier, and that was our family dynamics. That's the way that worked. Well, as I graduated college and got into the real estate business, I fell in love with marketing and selling ranches. And so as my careers developed and I became a partner in Hall & Hall, one of the most fascinating things is the commonality we have found across the nation in marketing and selling ranches. And that's my burden to you is to keep you from avoiding or to help you avoid the mistakes that we have seen time and time and time again. Because the end conclusion is
the
odds of you selling the ranch when you think you're going to sell it are pretty slim. And it's going to change hands either to your kids or to somebody that you don't know.
Who knows how the presidential elections are going
to go? Taylor's a partner of mine, and Taylor's developed a little bit different story, and Taylor was born into a ranching family and has had to trade some ranches because of his family dynamics and has seen some things repetitively over and over again. And we're talking about conservation issues. We're talking about production issues. If y'all know Taylor, Taylor's passion is growing grass and lots of it, and brush control, and really helping a ranch be its best. And that's why he's such an asset to this team.
Certainly, there's a great opportunity.
One of the interesting things about Texas is how unique it is. In all the other markets across the nation, we are truly on a 20-plus year bull run of Texas real estate.
That's something to definitely take a look at.
Which means for the most of the markets that we ranch in, we are so far beyond the production value of real estate that it's inconceivable. There is no way that you can buy a ranch in the state of Texas and expect a cow to pay for it. I was talking to one of the Capital Farm Credit guys earlier yesterday, and he said, yeah, he said, I just run the numbers for a guy. He said he can pay for this ranch in 107 years. And he was joking. He was serious, but it was funny to consider just because they still got to plug it into their spreadsheet. You know, here's a serious cow-calf rancher looking to expand their operation. And if you looked at it just from the cash flow of a cow-calf business, it was gonna pay itself off in 107 years. And that was with 30% equity, right? And I said, well, what about the cows? He said, well, you might have to take a few more years to pay for the cows. So we are in a very different situation than most of us acknowledge.
Illinois has 8.
Your ranch is
if you look at that,
such a huge bundle of wealth, and in any other industry, in any other cultural circumstance, we would have outside professionals managing this amount of wealth, right? Making sure we're buying the right stocks, making sure we're placing things in the right IRA. Well, we're all the time talking about stewardship, management of grass and fences and all those things. But for most people that we run across, one of the challenges is where they spend their money, on the ranch. And that's the point we're going to address. Most people that we sell new ranches to are very, very, very inclined to incorporate their kids into the ranch, right? They're buying the ranch because they're wanting to make sure the next generation appreciates what they appreciate. And that is an important factor to consider when you're setting up your management goals, or you're shaping your management goals, or you're bringing a kid back from
middle
college
class,
into the ranch.
Both
it's really important to
Dallas,
understand
Worth,
where that successorship is going, and that's going to determine a lot of things. It'll help you avoid a lot of traps.
They didn't get the 1,000; they got zero. Under the new law,
we all want to take a baseline of our management goals and understand that if we're really looking at the nuts and bolts and we're really looking at the values, right, of what we're doing with our ranch, and we want to believe that we're in the cattle business and we want to believe that we're in the cattle business for a profit of return, the very first measurement we got to take is, what would that ranch bring if I just rented it to my neighbor? That is a very leveling idea of how good of an asset manager I actually am. Because if you can't generate a return that's more than what your neighbor would pay in rent, you're probably paddling the wrong way down the street.
Really, if you have a child,
we need to think about that.
Ranch, and we all have kids that work on the ranch, maybe not as good as they need to. But pay them.
This haunting
my
voice
parents,
is killing
my
you guys. I'm sorry.
On the farm. I mean, I was driving a combine at age 14. Combine almost killed
you've
himself.
Got. We tend to look at a couple of different things and how we allocate our investments when it comes to the ranch. We've got the land investment and the improvements that we spend money on that ranch. And then we've got improvements that we're bringing to the ranch, and we believe that those improvements are going to bring us an operational return. Pretty significant distinction. So one of the things I want to do is we're just going to share with you some observations of broken ranches. You see it over and over again. Dan Kinzel came up to me a minute ago. We were talking about a piece of property in the river bottom, and this is a piece of property in an adjoining river bottom, and deep soil, lots of grass, and a pretty place. And we have an interesting history with a piece of property in that picture, and you tend to come across the same place over and over and over again. One of the things that I think you're going to be surprised to hear from me is, if you come to me and say, "Hey, Tyler, I want you to sell my ranch," you're going to be surprised at who the buyer is. Odds are the buyer is not going to be like you and is not going to have the same management goals that you have and the same purposes of owning the ranch and you. Honestly, some of these buyers, they just want a toy. And as I came on a partner in our company is a national company. We've got offices all the way up through north central Montana and Idaho and some of the really big mountain ranches. Got a long history there. And one of the patterns up there they've developed is most of those ranches up there sell every 7 to 10 years. And we've got a lot enough track history where we're seeing this pattern over and over again, and I think you're starting to see some of this in Texas. Well, what happens is, and say you take Montana, for example, that's a different market. When the Montana market started skyrocketing up, it was because East Coast money was pouring into Montana. East Coast money came in and said, "Hey, we want to own a Montana cattle ranch." Well, they didn't know what that meant. They just thought it was sexy. Well, so they buy these ranches and I need a manager. So we got in the business of hiring managers. Well, the manager, he's making us make tough decisions. I think maybe we just want to lease the ranch out. So we got into the management business. And then 7, 8, 10 years later, they decide, the kids have come out. They've ridden these horses. They've penned these cows. They've They've got their boots dirty, but they're not coming out anymore, so I think we're going to sell it. Well, that's great if you're in the ranch broker business because you get to sell it again. Well, you're seeing more and more and more of that in Texas. And you're seeing people that are buying ranches, they don't quite know what they're buying or how they're engaging them. I think this thing has a laser on it, doesn't it? Is that it? There it is. Right there. That's a place we sold a couple of years ago. That house was built in the 80s. It had the lavender toilets and it's about 8,000 square feet, and it was sitting on about 1,200 acres over a big lake. And I was told that the owners had stayed in that house seven times. And, I don't know what that house cost to build in the late 80s, early 90s, but I would assume a couple million dollars. And when it came time to sell that ranch, and we sold that ranch in a hurry for those folks, I think the ranch would have brought 20% more if that house hadn't been sitting on it. That's just a reality, The family did not, they knew they had this large asset in their portfolio, but they never thought about the management of that asset and what it looks like if it ever comes time to sell it or dispose of it. The title of that slide is Overcapitalization. We've got an embryo transfer facility here. I'm not going to tell you how much that embryo transfer facility cost, but it was a bunch. And the reality was he built that embryo transfer facility with a business plan that was very detailed, but in reality, all of his females got trucked down the road 15 miles to a facility where they got flushed. And all of the embryo work was done 15 miles the other way. And that ended up being nothing more than a place where they stored hay and feed for the most part. But when it came time to sell the ranch, it was a problem. Are we going to recapture that money? What are we going to do with it? At the end of the day, the guy that bought that ranch wanted a hunting ranch. What are you going to do? Is he going to pay for it? Market may not bear that. You also got the other reality of undercapitalization. My grandfather was a Depression-era guy, and the worst thing he hated was the end of the month when he got all the bills from his vendors, right? From the guys, all the places in town, we had charge accounts and things where we would go get tractor parts and feed bills and fertilizer bills. And the older he got, the harder it got for him to spend money on the ranch. And you end up with pastures full of goat weed and barns that serve no purpose. And those two pictures for me just kind of represent what happens when the wearisomeness of the management of the ranch results in just the checkbook getting folded up and put away. And that's a shame because so many of these places have so much to offer. And the buyers of today are, I use the word green, Taylor. Is that the word you would use? The majority of ranch buyers, we have buyers purchasing ranches at $10 million, $20 million, $30 million, $40 million that are first-time ranch buyers. And if it is not in tip-top shape, they're lost. They don't know what to do. But what do we mean by tip-top shape? There's lots of different valuable management ideas that are implemented on ranches. I've got quite a bit of experience in this concept of stock farming. I've developed some pivots and put some intensive grazing situations under circles. And the reality was that someone brought it to my attention one day that wasn't ranching, that was stock farming. But the truth of the matter is my goals had to do with an immediate return. I was looking for that annualized return, and I took our family ranch and I developed it in a way that will have no return to anybody in the future. Those center pivots on our ranch will have no value to anybody in the future. And it's why? Because of the way I set it up. I set it up in a way that at today's real estate prices, nobody's going to come in and look at our family ranch and go, "Oh, wow, man, you've got a really cool setup for rotational grazing. I think I'll pay you an extra $2,000 an acre for that." No, they're going to come out to the ranch and they're going to look at it and go, "What is that? And why did you do that? And why do you have those troughs scattered across? And what's that big steel thing?" And, you know, it just absolutely does not fit where the market's at. But that's an example of kind of a hyper-specialization in our ranch management that does affect the future value of what you own. We always laugh about the heavy metal trap. And the heavy metal trap is can have wheels or it cannot have wheels. Some of the heavy metal traps we find are welded down and cemented in place, and some of them have wheels. I will tell you that is the coolest piece of equipment to come on the market I've ever seen. Anybody go to NCBA and notice this thing? Self-propelled hay baler that Vermeer's come out with. You can roll up 600 bales a day with this dude. And with the accelerated depreciation, you can get some good depreciation on $250,000 in no time, right? But we walk into situations where, whether it be hay balers or processing facilities or barns or where all of this money has been spent, and the reality is that the owner likes buying stuff. And that is not something that the market will recapture for you. You've already taken your depreciation. You've already gotten your bonus out of that. And so I've sold one ranch in my memory that I can remember where I felt like the guy got out good with all the heavy metal. And that was because it just hit it just right, and they went ahead and had a whole consignment auction at the ranch, and, you know, bat wings that should have brought $2,000 brought $6,000 and what have you. But it is a trap, and we do advise that you avoid it. Water development is always a good investment. So ponds, lakes, water distribution systems, and water sources. Taylor and I were throwing around some numbers yesterday, just thinking about this. And, you know, surface water is probably 2 to $12,000 per surface acre improvement right now. So if you've got a 5-acre pond, you know, you're talking about adding, you know, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 to the value of your property. The solar wells of today, let me get a sip of water. The solar wells of today are really a game changer. We can put water where we couldn't put water before. The other thing that's changed is drilling technology. Sorry, guys. Drilling technology, that's a well that was drilled
in Central Texas. You might have to take this over. My breakfast is getting to me. Whew. Why don't you take that? I'll be right back.
Well, guys. How do you follow that up, Mom? We have definitely had, God has got a sense of humor, I guess, or somebody is angry at us today. Because if we could have had a discussion or an instance of everything that could possibly go wrong during a demonstration, we have had it today. So thank you for being patient with us. I appreciate that. Water development. The single most important thing that you can do on your property or to add value to your property is anything that has to do with water. 9 times out of 10, right? We say that water's worth $8,000 to $10,000, roughly a surface acre. Your land's worth maybe $2,000 a surface acre. I say make the whole ranch water. Huh? My dad wanted to kill me at our last ranch because we started out, we had a water, we had like, say, a pond. I live in Oklahoma now. I've got to call them ponds. Sorry. Tank. We had a tank to every 200 acres. When I was done, we had one to every 80 acres. And my dad said, Taylor, don't you dig another pond. I said, but Daddy, I said, we need to make the whole ranch water. We need to make this whole place water. And, of course, he thought I was crazy until a neighbor showed up, wanted to buy the ranch, and I priced it ridiculously high, and he bought it from me. That's been my whole story, is I'm one of those A-type anal people. Do we have any of those people in here today? Come on, identify. Are you anal? Are you particular? That is me. My wife wants to kill me. It is horrible to be her. And so what I've done my entire life is I will go buy a ranch, and I will fix everything that bothers me. And what happens is somebody comes along later, and they offer me too much money for that ranch, and so I sell. I'm on ranch number 4 right now. I'm a habitual ranchaholic, right? It's a disease I have. I'm on number 4. I just sold out in the Flint Hills of Kansas on Tuesday and bought a ranch in Throckmorton County. Who goes from the Flint Hills to Throckmorton County, right? This guy does. Obviously, there's an issue. I need some counseling. Water development, it's one of the greatest things that you can do to your ranch. Let's see, what do we got next? Commercial versus seed stock. What kind of business are you going to be in on your ranch, right? Can you play with the big boys? Everything that I'm going to give you is from a real estate salesman perspective, okay? And what I have noticed is most everybody that wants to play with the big boys does for 3 to 5 years. 3 to 5 years, then they call me, right? Taylor, what do I do with this? And then I've got to show up and I've got to lie worse to them than I have to my wife a lot of times, right? Because I'm like, listen, I know you bought the XR8792 Elixir Bull for $150,000 at Denver, but you know what? He's worth, I can't get you 20 cents on the dollar. And he's like, Taylor, look at this $100,000 bull. Do you see it? And I'm like, no, I don't. But I'm like, yes, I do. It's my favorite bull I've ever seen. Can you afford to play at that level? Right? That's a level that most people can't afford to play with. So be careful, right? Maybe the best thing you can do is just keep it, right? Just stay in your lane. Stay at a value that you can play at. What about inter-family dynamics, right? Who's going to take over the ranch? Can they take over the ranch? What's the ranch going to become, right? What will the ranch become? What is it going to look like? Next, be careful about getting yourself into hyper-focused systems, right? What I mean by that, like, don't so specialize in just one thing that you've taken yourself out of the market. Don't do it. We see it time and time again, high-fence ranches. You know what? I love to go on high-fence ranches because usually I hadn't had cattle on them in a while, and usually they're in really good shape. But to get, especially in Oklahoma or Kansas where I am, to get you any kind of value out of that, the best thing I can do is tell you to go cut that thing down and lay it over. You know, the chances of me finding you another guy that's going to pay you for all that, we're not seeing it, right? So be careful. Be careful about, like Tyler was talking about earlier, mob grazing, right? I love it. I'm not going to disrespect it. I see great value in it, but most of the time when I go look at a ranch that's for sale and somebody that's bought into it, it hasn't worked well for them, right?
And I'm not saying it won't work well. I'm not saying it's a good system. But what I'm telling you is that most of the time what I see is I see people spend all of this money, and then they call me needing me to sell it and try to get that value back out. And it won't happen. We can't get it for you most of the time. So be careful.
And that's a picture of a cutting horse operation.
Yeah, be careful about a cutting horse deal. If you're in Weatherford, Texas, and in the right place, hey, it can work. It can work. But be careful about building too much, too fancy, too nice, or whatever. So tenant depreciation, awesome. What kind of tenant do you have on your place? Are they going to take care of your property, right? A lot of times you're a whole lot better to take less money and have a good tenant on that property, right? People ask me all the time, Taylor, what can I do to fix this ranch up? I don't have much money. I'd say, awesome, listen, I'm going to tell you what you can do to be ahead of 90% of the population. If you'll just clean up junk, if you'll just pick up stuff and get rid of it and properly stock your ranch, you'll be ahead of the game. You'll be ahead of 90% of the people in your neighborhood. I'm shocked how many calls I get from people in Texas. People say, Taylor, can you come tell me what I need to do to add value to my ranch? What do I need to do out here? And I say, listen, I probably don't need to come out there. I can save you some time and myself a trip too. If you just take everything off the ranch and call me in 2 years, call me after the second frost. Because that's normally the case. Normally what we see, everything is severely, usually when we get it, when it gets to our point, it's severely overgrazed, right? So obviously at some point your ranch is going to come up. It's going to be for sale at some point. Make sure it's in good shape. Try to take good care of it, right? If you just take good care of it, keep it cleaned up, right? Get you some people that'll take care of your ranch. If you're going to lease it out, make sure they have stocking rates and make sure they have certain requirements on what they have to spend on the ranch and take care of it, because you can find some good long-term tenants that will take good care of your ranch.
When the successorship starts deteriorating, one of the commonalities we see is you'll the family will lease the ranch to the old ranch manager, and the old ranch manager will play out or his health will deteriorate, mm-hmm. and the next thing you know, it's leased to a good tenant, something happens to the good tenant, then it's leased to a bad tenant, and then we get a call that it's time to sell the ranch.
That's right.
Well, if you can keep a good tenant on it, you may not have to sell it.
That's right. And it helps us so many times in marketing a ranch. If there's good management in place, if there's cash flow in place, structures in place, if you've got a good set of hunters, bringing in good residual income, it's all a plus to help. Regularly value your ranch, right? Appraisals. There's plenty of real estate people that'll come out and look at it. Get somebody reputable, a good person in the area, tell them to come out. If you got questions about improvements, ask. Right?
One of the things that's important to do is Donnell stole my thunder on this, but communicating with your family. You know, you've got different generations that are interested in different things, and it really gets to be a problem when you're trying to manage for multiple purposes on the same piece of real estate, and the communication's not there to make them coexist. So you can pull up to a ranch and say, oh gosh, it's clear what they do on this ranch. It's clear with how they're operating this ranch. And you go to the next one, and it's a little bit of a circus because they're trying to do embryo transfer work on zebras and camels on the same ranch that they're trying to run a registered Brangus operation, and they don't mix.
That's right. Stick to clean and functional working improvements. Ask yourself, do I really need this? Is this really going to add that much value? One of the biggest problem in our businesses is that we work with a lot of really wealthy A-type people, and they've made a whole lot of money in one area of their life, and they decide they're going to get in the cattle business and show everybody else how to do it. And everyone around them is on the payroll and works with them. And so everything they decide to do on the ranch is the greatest idea. It's the greatest thing you could ever do. You know, Carl, I think we need a 10,000 square foot house, and I think we need an 8,000 square foot guest house, and you know, I think we need a Ferris wheel. You know, you laugh. I haven't seen a Ferris wheel yet, but it's close. But make sure what you're building, like, build a ranch hand's house. Build two houses. Don't build an 8,000 square foot house. Please don't build anything over four.
And think about how the next generation will see that improvement.
That's right, because these younger generations, they don't want the house. They don't want the headache. you know? People my age, a lot of my age don't want, it's like, I don't want the payments. I don't want to mess with it. Give me a 2,500 square foot house so I can go travel and enjoy my life still, right? Right. What about brush control, mineral development, water development? We've talked about a lot of this on brush control, right? Be careful. Don't do nothing and don't take it all. Stay in the middle somewhere, right? You've got to be so, make sure you're not so one-dimensional in this business, right? Make sure you've got, the best ranches, in my opinion, that you can buy is something with good hunting and good cattle. I call them combination ranches. But when you're too stuck on one or the other, you can get in trouble. What about mineral development, right? We've learned a lot. We've learned a lot over these shale plays and stuff. If you're going to make an oil and gas lease, at least try to control a little bit how they outlay the wells, how it affects the property. And like we said, avoid monotony and monocultures, right? Nobody wants all open grass. Awesome. And protect the history of the ranch. Guys, do y'all have any questions? I apologize. We kind of got thrown in the middle here and had to adjust. Yes, sir. Oh my gosh. That's a loaded question right there. Yeah. He said, have we had any incidences with wind towers? And so, let me tell you yes and no. Can I say that? Yes and no. I am in the Tulsa office in Oklahoma. And in Oklahoma, you can't sever the wind rights. So, in Oklahoma, if you have wind towers on your property, it actually helps the value because the income has to pass. And then most Texas wind leases that I've seen personally, I'm not saying that I am not the wind authority, whatever, but most leases that I've seen, once you sign that lease, you cannot sever your wind rights from that property. And so a lot of times it does help the value quite a bit. I am not a fan. I have yet to meet the person that's a fan besides the person that's getting a check.
But it does, yeah. Your neighboring place, your, you know, all those things, it does affect values.
Yes.
And you can't believe anybody says it doesn't. So we've seen several properties that have not been able to move because of wind towers on them or wind towers on their neighbors. And it's just a reality.
Yep.
Did I answer the question?
Yeah.
Ma'am? Well, solar is so encumbering to the surface that becomes the sole and only use of the probably what you see more is the fight about the transmission than the actual farm itself.
Yeah. Good, sir. You. Sure. Right, and that's what's very hard about a lot of these questions, because we're being very general, because it all depends on areas. And that's what's so hard, because everybody's from such a different area. But I would say probably you'll double your investment put in on water development like that.
On a true operating ranch, the biggest difference you find is just your the attractiveness to a buyer being able to steward the ranch and get cattle grazing where they weren't grazing before and up your capacity a little bit. Just utilization.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a, nothing's going there.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Well,
man, that's
tough.
That is a brutal question right there. And that's when I say,
I'll share with you two things I've learned from about toll roads is don't ever believe that a toll road's going to bring you value because you've got more frontage now. Yeah. Don't believe that. Most toll roads diminish access. They don't grant access. And then also don't, you know, until they come knocking on your door asking a survey, it's not a real project. Good. Then this probably ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it depends on the market. You know, all real estate's local, and you know, if you've got a direct impact coming, you need to, you know, you're going to have to determine that on a case by case basis. Because if it's really going to sever the ranch and make it to the point that it's not functional, it's going to be too hard to operate as a unit, then that's becomes a personal decision on, you know, gosh, how do we operate this thing when the ranch is cut in half? And, you know, are we going to sacrifice maybe some future value to go make that transition somewhere else? Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a small world, and the internet's an amazing thing. You know, if you know that toll road's coming, most of your buyers are going to as well, and you'd want to disclose it to them.
Yes, ma'am.
You mentioned getting regular appraisals. How often do you recommend getting your land appraised?
Ooh, I think it depends on what I would get a rough idea every 4 to 5 years, maybe. Depends on what, if you think, you know, if you think something major is going to happen pretty soon or whatever. But, you know, the farm credit guys around, I mean, there's enough people that'll give you almost, you know, a rough idea if you don't need to be that specific. But, you know,
it's important to know what is sold around you. It's good to know. It's always good to know that issue. And then, you know, a good broker, a good relationship with an appraiser can always kind of keep you up to date on where you're at. And, you know, if you're just looking for it for succession purposes to your family or whatever, you know, your tax accountants and those guys, they need to know. They need to know kind of where you're sitting. Yeah. So.
As a follow-up to that, have y'all, either of you, had much experience brokering properties that are under perpetual easement?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, it seems to me Oklahoma, Kansas, Texas, they're still, everybody's still pretty much against them. And the Montana, Wyoming properties, it's not as big of a burden. Yeah. What maybe,
you've
sometimes
seen,
it's not affecting the value even, but we're working on some Kansas properties, and it's 40%. She was talking about how much the conservation easements are affecting property values and what we're seeing. Where I'm in Kansas and Oklahoma, I mean, it's at least 50 cents on the dollar that you lose the day you sign that conservation easement. Let me take that back. It depends on how brutal. We've dealt with some conservation easements where you can't even take an ATV off a road. You can't split the property. You can't build any structures on them. Those are severely limiting, you know. And then we've dealt with some that are wishy-washy. But overall, nobody says, "Well, I would really like to find a property with a conservation easement on it." And I would really like some people to come out here every year and be looking at what I'm doing on my own place and tell me that what I can and can't do and whatever. So
I would say that the more recreational oriented a ranch is, probably the less decrease in value you'll suffer. So if it is a ranch that is a productive ranch and a big wide open space, you know, the easement probably is going to diminish the value more than, say, if you're in the hill country where open space is highly valued because of the recreational component of it. You know, you're probably not going to see as big of a...
Yes, ma'am.
Their land and that easement too. And so there's this fight. They raise their children
Yeah. 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 Yes, ma'am. Yes. That's right.
I would say, for most situations in Texas, yeah. Right here, right now, I would say you're receiving the benefit when you take the easement, the write down you're taking when you're taking the easement. But you know, there are easements of every shape, size, color, and nature, and they affect every piece of property differently.
Any more questions? Guys, thanks so much for being flexible with us or whatever. We'll be up here to talk at the front if you've got any more questions, whatever. Thank you.